Firefighters are chasing a series of new fires because of recent thunderstorms that brought lots of lightning. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetic, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry talks about an effort that aims to save room for open space. And in tonight's feature interview, Capitol reporter Dan Boyce speaks with an associated professor at Harvard Medical School about the rehabilitation that many cancer survivors are not getting. In the last 24 hours, the Lolo National Forest area has had 20 lightning-caused fires. Most of the lightning strikes were in Plains, Thompson Falls, and Superior Ranger districts. All of the fires have been contained. And the Nine Mile District responded to three fires, one of which was an abandoned campfire. While yesterday and today, the Sealy Lake Ranger District has had five reports of smoke and one fire. That fire was near Nome Point, 12 miles east of Sealy Lake. The fire is now less than 1 acre. Also, the Missoula District responded to one lightning-caused fire today. The fire is about 12 miles east of Stevensville and is less than an acre in size. Firefighters continue to clean up the Woodman Saddle Fire east of Blue Mountain Lookout and the Gold Creek Fire 16 miles northeast of Missoula.
And another news from around the state, a Montana-based Air Force unit that operates one-third of the nation's land-based nuclear missile force has failed a safety and security inspection. The general in charge of the Air Force's nuclear force told the Associated Press this marks the second major setback this year for a force charged with the military's most sensitive mission. The failure was recorded by the 341st Missile Wing at Malmstrom Air Force Base. That base is responsible for 150 Minutemen, three nuclear missiles. Lieutenant General James Kowalski, commander of the Air Force Global Strike Command, is responsible for the Minutemen III Force, as well as the nuclear bombers. Kowalski says the 341st Wing failed a small team exercise as part of a broader inspection. He says the exercise failure meant the whole inspection was a failure. Kowalski said this did not call into question the unit's safe operation of nuclear missiles, but was its second failure of a safety and security inspection in just over 3 years. Kowalski would not discuss details of the failure or explain the exercise, citing security, except to say that it did not involve the crews who monitor the missiles from inside underground launch control capsules. That left open the possibility that it involved airmen responsible for security, weapons maintenance, or other aspects of the highly sensitive mission. He said those who failed the exercise would be retested within 3 months. This is the second major setback this year for the Air Force's nuclear weapons force. Last spring, the 91st Missile Wing in Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, received weak grades on an inspection, but it did not fail it outright. That performance was so poor, however, that 19 officers temporarily lost their authority to operate missiles.
Federal officials are delaying a scientific analysis of a plan to drop legal protections for gray wolves across most of the lower 48 states after three experts who had criticized the proposal were excluded from the review panel. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said in June that the wolf should be removed from the endangered species list because it has recovered after disappearing from most of the nation decades ago. The agency wants to continue protections in the Southwest. The private contractor is overseeing a legally required peer review of the government's plan. Last week, the contractor told three scientists they couldn't serve on the panel because they'd signed a letter supporting continued wolf protections. A spokesman said today that the Fish and Wildlife Service is reconsidering the review process.
Environmentalists upset with the federal government proposal to remove protections for wolves across most of the U.S. have posted a manual on how to sabotage wolf hunts. The 12-page manual published online yesterday by Earth First instructs would-be saboteurs on how to find traps and take them out, and how to release a trapped wolf. It also suggests blockades where wolf permits are sold and walking ahead of hunters with air horns. Earth First media spokesman Grayson Flory says hunting and trapping is driving wolves nearly to extinction, and people should be able to stop those activities if they want to. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks spokesman Ron Asheim says it's illegal to harass hunters and disturb traps, and a person who breaks the law will be prosecuted.
U.S. Representative Steve Daines is going to Israel on a congressional trip. Daines' office said the Republican is joining other congressmen to meet with Israeli and Palestinian leaders this week. They will discuss the country's relationship with the United States, the peace process, regional security, and other issues. Daines says the nation's security interests are directly tied with Israel's. The freshman congressman said he also hopes to discuss economic opportunities for Montana businesses. The trip is being paid for the American Israel Education Foundation, a privately funded group that lobbies for pro-Israel policies in Washington, D.C.
One of the men accused of killing a Montana high school teacher has made a deal with prosecutors that would spare him the death penalty. A change of plea hearing was scheduled for Lester Van Waters Jr. this afternoon in Sydney. Prosecutors say Waters and Michael Spell abducted Sherry Arnold in January 2012 while the Sydney high school teacher was out for a morning jog. They are accused of killing her and burying her body in a North Dakota field. Court documents filed yesterday say Waters has agreed to plead guilty to deliberate homicide by accountability. In exchange, prosecutors will drop an attempted kidnapping charge and recommend a sentence of 100 years in prison with 20 years suspended. Waters also has agreed to cooperate with the state's prosecution of Spell.
The unsolved death of a 21-year-old lame deer woman on the Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation prompted a rally in which as many as 200 people marched through lame deer and demanded justice for victims of unsolved murders on American Indian reservations nationwide. Hannah Harris went missing early on July 4th, and her body was found 4 days later along Muddy Creek, a few miles from where her car had been found. An autopsy didn't determine a cause of death, and the FBI says it is waiting a toxicology results. But Melinda Harris Limberhand is convinced her daughter was killed. The Billings Gazette reports a lack of information about her case resulted in yesterday's Justice for Hannah rally. Several people spoke, demanding more action from tribal officials and law enforcement in investigating the deaths of tribal members.
A Laurel man is charged with assaulting an elderly man and trying to set fire to his house. The Billings Gazette reports 25-year-old Adam Scott Nelson appeared in justice court in Billings yesterday on charges of aggravated burglary, aggravated assault, robbery, and attempted arson. He is jailed with bail set at $12,000. Prosecutors say Nelson met the man in 2011, and the man allowed Nelson and his family to live in his house because the family had been living in a vehicle. Court records say the elderly man's family felt Nelson was taking advantage of him and kicked Nelson out. One night last December, someone broke into the elderly man's house, beat him, took his wallet, then tried to set fire to the house. Laurel police say they recovered evidence linking Nelson to the crime.
A large water purification unit for an oil sands project in Canada made its way through Missoula early today after a brief protest. No arrests were made. The 225-foot load encountered numerous protests last week as it traveled through tribal land and federally protected river corridor in northern Idaho. Police Sergeant Jerry Alden says between 20 and 25 protesters stepped onto the road in front of the load in Missoula. He says Montana Highway Patrol officers ordered them off the road, and about 2 minutes later, they left. The load continued onto the truck stop at Bonner, where it stayed today. The loads can only travel at night. The road left at the port of Wilma near Clarkston, Washington, on August 5th.
Visitation was down a bit last month in Yellowstone National Park, but vehicle traffic was up. Park spokesman Al Nash says the park started using a new method of counting visitors this year.
And to do so, we come up with a multiplier based on surveys of people who come into the park. We've been using the same number to create that visitation figure for almost two decades. We suspected that it was not as accurate as it might be. So last summer, we did a new survey, and it resulted in a lower persons per vehicle multiplier, which we began using this year. So if you compare 2013 visitation figures to 2012, you're going to see that 2013 numbers are lower.
Monthly visitation statistics are calculated by taking the actual number of wheeled vehicles entering the park gates and using a person per vehicle multiplier to calculate the number of recreational visitors. For example, during the summer months, Yellowstone previously used an average multiplier of 2.91 persons per vehicle. Based on the survey, it currently uses a lower average multiplier of 2.58 persons per vehicle. Nash says 1.8 million recreational visitors visited the park during the first 7 months of this year.
That's compared to 1.93 million for the same seven-month period last year. But, you know, the trends are the same. We start out slowly, May begins to pick up, and July is always our biggest month. Over 812,000 people came into Yellowstone in July alone.
Nash says August is typically Yellowstone's second busiest month. Autumn is very popular there as well.
People who don't have to deal with school schedules have found that September is a great time to visit the park. And frankly, over the course of years, we've seen September visitation has increased.
Two wildfires are burning in Yellowstone, but Nash describes their fire activity as relatively subdued.
Saving room for open space is among the goals behind conservation and land trust efforts. An effort in the Flathead aims to maintain farmland, open space, wildlife habitat, and water quality. Katrin Fry reports on a nearly 200-acre property that would add to a conservation neighborhood on the north shore of Flathead Lake.
Land protection specialist Laura Katzman with the Flathead Land Trust tells the story of a 189-acre piece of property originally farmed by homesteaders in the 1800s.
They actually were a family that lived in Canada and came to the North Shore to winter, because the winters here were easier than up there, I guess. They're the ones that built the old white house that used to be here and the barn.
The old barn still stands, surrounded by recently harvested fields, broken up by islands of ponderosa pine groves. It sits along the north shore of Flathead Lake, with the neighbor to the west, a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service waterfowl production area. Nearby Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has a wildlife management area and state park. Across the highway, more than 150 acres are part of the Flathead Land Trust, and the Montana Land Reliance has a nearly 30-acre land trust in the neighborhood.
The North Shore Flathead Lake has so many neat resources that are already protected by the Fish and Wildlife Service waterfowl production area, but the neighboring agricultural land is actually very important to the migratory waterfowl that come through here, the tens of thousands of birds in the spring and fall, and it's also really great farmland, so it's a really good place to continue to, I guess, work on with interested landowners to protect.
Katzman says the current owner bought the property in the 1990s.
And he's a conservation-minded landowner, and he wanted to sell the property, but he didn't really want to see it developed. So he had been holding off trying to wait for the right buyer and trying to think of ways we could work with him on conservation.
FWP is looking to buy this property using money from the Bonneville Power Administration. The funding comes through FWP's Fisheries Mitigation Program to help offset impacts associated with the construction of Hungry Horse Dam. BPA would keep a perpetual conservation easement on the property if FWP acquires it in order to ensure long-term protection. Farther west, along the North Shore, some of the farmland on the edge of the town of Summers has seen residential development, and other residential development is being pursued. Katzman says this area is one of the spots where they'd like to work with as many interested landowners as they can to maintain the open space of the North Shore farmland.
Usually a conservation easements, I guess, tries to limit is high-density residential subdivision or industrial activities. So trying to maintain the open space and the fish and wildlife habitat and the prime soils.
FWP is seeking public comment about whether to acquire the property. It's holding an open house at the Flathead Lake Inn at the intersection of U.S. 93 and Highway 82 in Summers next Tuesday, August 20th, starting at 6. It'll collect public comment until the end of August. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
A motorcycle struck a deer in Missoula, causing a passenger on the bike to suffer fatal injuries. The Montana Highway Patrol tells KECI-TV that the motorcycle hit the deer at about 10:45 p.m. on Sunday. The driver, a 21-year-old Missoula man, was hospitalized with unknown injuries. The passenger, a 27-year-old man from Houston, died of his injuries at a Missoula hospital yesterday. The victim's name hasn't been released. Neither man was wearing a helmet. The deer died in the collision.
Nearly 5,000 Montanans are diagnosed with cancer every year. That's according to figures from the Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services. And an estimated 42,000 cancer survivors are living in the state right now. But even if they are free from the disease, many of these survivors are still dealing with long-lasting impacts from the treatments which saved their lives. Dr. Julie Silver is a rehabilitation physician and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. She believes the medical community is at large is not recognizing the need for therapy to help survivors recover from harsh cancer treatments. In tonight's feature interview with Capitol reporter Dan Boyce, Dr. Silver talks about a program she started to help reverse this trend and the two Montana hospitals that are implementing it. She says she became particularly interested in the issue after she was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2003.
I A physician who was busy practicing, working full-time, seeing patients. I had three little kids at home that I was raising, and a husband. I was a daughter, a wife, a mother, a sister, a friend, a physician, all these different roles in my life. And boom, I was diagnosed with cancer. Felt really good going into treatment. And got really, really, really sick as I went through treatment. And when I was finished with my last chemotherapy appointment and infusion, I talked to my oncologist and I said, what do I do now? And he said, go home and try to heal. And if you feel better at some point, try to go back to work. And I thought, wow, that's really hard to do on your own, just to sort of take yourself off and try to heal all by yourself. And as a rehabilitation doctor, I'd actually never given that advice to anyone. So I was kind of surprised.
Again, the impairments we're talking about here, you mentioned pain, weakness, cognitive issues, balance issues. These are from the treatments given for cancer, not from the illness.
Right. It could be a combination of both. In my case, it was from the treatments, but cancer itself can cause physical impairments, and the treatments can cause physical impairments. So some cancer survivors, they live with cancer as a chronic condition. They're never done with treatment, and they always, they're always fighting the cancer. So the cancer itself can certainly cause lots of physical problems. But, the treatments to try and cure or put the cancer in remission also cause a lot of problems. You know, I was very, very tired. I was in a lot of pain. I was very weak. In fact, I did exercise testing on myself, and I had gone from a woman in my 30s to a woman in my 60s. And I was really surprised. I felt like, wow, I've aged three decades in the matter of months.
When we go to a doctor for a serious injury, say from a car crash or a skiing accident, rehabilitation is usually part of that process, usually a big part of that process. But what you're saying here is that is not typically the case with cancer care. Why is that? How do we get in that place where rehabilitation from the treatment is not a piece of our medical puzzle?
I wish I knew the answer to that question. Boy, it does seem just really astonishing, because we offer rehabilitation to people that have had strokes, to people who are in car accidents. If you have a hip replacement, you get rehab. Even if you have a sports injury, an ankle sprain, you get rehab. So this idea of treating millions of people for their cancer and giving them lots of toxic treatments, but then sending them home to figure out how to heal on their own just doesn't make any sense at all. We are nevertheless in that situation for many survivors, many of the listeners listening in Montana right now, and they're thinking, wow, I went through cancer, or my spouse did, or my friend did, and they were never offered rehab. And it's a shame, because we have really good research that supports this care. We have clinicians, physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech language pathologists, and doctors who specialize in this that can offer this care, and medical insurance pays for it.
Because of your experience, you developed the STAR program, an acronym is for Survivorship Training and Rehab. And this is for hospitals. In the STAR program, we have two Montana hospitals that participate in this, St. Peter's Hospital here in Helena and Bozeman Deaconess Hospital. Why don't you talk about the types of training that those hospitals receive and how it changes their outlook on this topic?
Well, at Bozeman Deaconess, there is a STAR program coordinator named Sherry Wells, and Sherry is a speech-language pathologist, and she has been a huge champion for the STAR program and for cancer rehabilitation at Bozeman, really trying to bring better care to survivors who are diagnosed with cancer and treated there. And one of the things that Sherry and her team have been trained to do is to assess these patients for physical problems, to identify them, and then to treat them appropriately. And this can be, for example, a head and neck cancer survivor who is not able to drive because he can't turn his head very well and see oncoming traffic. or it can be a woman who went through breast cancer treatment and can't really lift her arm overhead. Lots and lots of problems that people can develop. And at St. Peter's, that has really been spearheaded by a woman named Marjane Heisler. And she really was inspired by some of the nurse navigators at St. Peter's. And the job of the nurse navigators is to navigate patients through the system. And these navigators realized, my goodness, you know, these patients are really suffering. There's more that we can be doing. And they teamed up with Marjane and said, we really want to bring this to St. Peter's and develop a cancer rehabilitation program. So, you know, a lot of times what we see is we see a champion or a group of champions that say, you know, our patients are really suffering. We can do more to help. Let's do this.
You mentioned that cancer treatments can affect people in a lot of different ways. When you're approaching rehabilitation there, you need physicians from multiple types of disciplines working toward that end goal, don't you?
Right. You definitely want to have multiple healthcare professionals. And that's really what I want to point out, is there's a distinct difference between a general exercise and wellness program, for example, going to your local YMCA or even going to a hospital-based exercise program. Those are fantastic, but that's not really what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about is individualized one-on-one care, similar to someone who's had a stroke or been in a car accident, where their specific problems are identified and treated. And that's what your health insurance covers. So if you went to just a general exercise class, chances are good your health insurance wouldn't cover that. And they wouldn't really treat the specific problems that you have, which doesn't mean it's not a good idea to go to a general exercise class, but I'm just trying to separate general exercise and wellness from cancer rehabilitation care.
Dr. Silver, what are your long-term goals here? How would you like to change the standard of care following cancer treatment for folks? And how is that evolving around the country?
Well, I really want cancer rehabilitation to be the standard of care. I want doctors to begin to own this and to say to themselves, you know, it's my job to identify these problems in patients and not to basically have survivors have to self-identify problems to their doctors. I think that's really important for doctors to basically say, I'm educated about this, I understand these problems, and I know how to refer to healthcare professionals. So, for example, at St. Peter's and at Bozeman Deaconess, they have a whole team now that are there ready and waiting to treat these patients. What will likely happen is that a lot of your listeners will say, gee, you know, I'm having problems, or someone I know is having problems, and they will self-refer. Ideally, I would like the doctors to really step in and say, my patients are struggling with these, and I now know where to refer them. It will take a while to get there, and there's some absolutely wonderful doctors, oncologists, in general, are just wonderful people. And they're starting to really realize, and many of them have already, you know, understood this great need, that when you have a trained team that you can really trust, like they have at St. Peter's and at Bozeman Deaconess, that getting those patients into the hands of these healthcare professionals is the best possible thing that you can do for them.
Dr. Julie Silver, Associate Professor at Harvard Medical School and a specialist in rehabilitation medicine. Dr. Silver, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And in tonight's weather forecast, for west of the Divide, tonight calls for partly cloudy skies with scattered showers and thunderstorms and areas of smoke. Lows will be in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tomorrow will be mostly clear with areas of smoke in the morning. Highs will stay in the mid-80s to lower 90s. For central Montana tonight, expect mostly to partly cloudy skies with scattered showers and thunderstorms that may produce heavy rainfall. Lows will be between 50 to 60 degrees. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies in the morning, then clearing. A slight chance of showers and thunderstorms are likely through the day. Highs will stay in the 80s. And for southwest Montana, tonight calls for mostly cloudy skies, then clearing. Isolated showers and thunderstorms are likely. Lows will range between 45 to 55 degrees. Tomorrow will be mostly clear with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening. Highs will be in the 80s. And now for the editorial comments of Dan Gallagher.
This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint. President Obama spoke to the Disabled American Veterans, the DAV, convention just last weekend and reassured them that his administration is making progress in resolving the shameful backlog in veterans' claims. By the way, the criteria for considering a claim as backlogged is whether it's been in the system for 125 days or more. Now, that number as a criteria is ludicrous. Speaking realistically, I've never known of a VA claim that was resolved in as few as 125 days. In fact, it often takes years for a claim to make its way through the VA's labyrinth. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm glad for whatever progress is being made in the effort to determine service connection and compensability. It's a national disgrace to watch as those who've served our country are left dangling in the wind when they return home from war needing help in dealing with the results of that war. The administration has hired more adjudicators to decide a claim's viability, and the current reviewers have been ordered to put in more hours. On the surface, this seems an enlightened solution to the backlog problem, and likely it's helped expedite some claims. But that effort does not address what I believe is a primary reason for backlogs and rejections of claims. The system now in place, and that has been in place for decades, seems to establish the VA as the veteran's adversary rather than the veteran's advocate that it was intended to be. It's as if a major goal is to have a much greater number of claims denials than claims approvals. Pursuing a claim is really a legal proceeding, with a veteran eventually sitting before an adjudicator who seems delighted to be termed a judge rather than a facilitator. It's a system that's intimidating and even in some ways unfair. There are many ways that the underlying us-versus-them problem might be addressed. For example, what about that agency looking at the existence of the veteran's problem first, beginning treatment upon the claim filing, and then looking to verify the source of the problem later in a long-term resolution? I'll not dwell on this issue further, except to say to all who decide how to deal with veterans' claims, what's being done now hasn't worked well in the past, and it won't prove to be significantly more successful in the future. And isn't repeating an unsuccessful act over and over, expecting to achieve a different result, an apt definition of stupidity or insanity? Now, in his speech to the DAV, the president also included references to educational benefits for veterans, and that's certainly timely, what with fall approaching. The GI Bill, originally brought to life as the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, has sent millions of veterans to post-secondary classrooms, and it continues to do so. So if you're a veteran, get your GI Bill paperwork in. You're already late. And stop by the registrar's office or that of a vet's representative at the school you'll be attending. Do it now. And there's something else that can't or shouldn't wait in the veterans' world, and that's the sharing of your veteran stories with your spouse and kids and grandkids and all the others in your life. It's an important part of their history and their heritage, and they have both the right and the need to know. Now, I recognize that talking about war experiences can be uncomfortable to the point of impossibility, but you veterans need to find a way to get past that fear and to open up to those who carry your blood and your interests within them. And this also goes for those family members. Find a way to get that veteran in your life to talk about what he did in the war and what war did to his world. The result can be that both you and your veteran loved one will be emotionally healthier, will share an understanding that brings both appreciation and tolerance, and you will likely be much, much closer. Now, what brings this up is the death recently of a Vietnam veteran friend whose sons were shocked to learn after his death of the medals he'd won in a Yadrang Valley battle. One of his sons even told me that he'd totally forgotten that his dad had served. There had been distancing and separation between father and son, and no one, probably not even them, knew why it had reached that point. Respect between them was virtually non-existent. No doubt some of the strain came from Dad's inability or unwillingness to deal with unresolved war issues, and from the sons believing that their father's coldness reflected a lack of love or concern for them. Both sides were wrong. After the funeral, I heard the expectable lines. I didn't know, and I wish I had known when I could have done something about it. But they had never asked, just as he had never told, and it ended that way. How sad. Veterans, there are ways to communicate your war and military experiences to your kids. Veteran family members, there are ways to help your veteran share what's in his war-affected heart and mind. Learn it. Do it. Share it. Don't let your heritage slip into a grave when it could be enriching the lives of all whom the veteran had touched in life. And this is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint.
Dan Gallagher is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.